Good morning. I'm Amanda McNulty with Clemson Extension and Making It Grow. And this is a Making It Grow Extra, one of our podcasts. And today I'm speaking with David Coyle. David is an extension specialist. David, what are your particular responsibilities?
Good morning, Amanda. My responsibilities are forest health and invasive species. And that's a pretty wide range of things. It's everything from pesticides to insects to fungi to invasive plants, pretty much anything that impacts a forestry or a tree in an urban environment.
And trees are extraordinarily important to the economy of South Carolina, and our urban trees are important for the aesthetics that they bring and also for the cooling effects, the mitigation on rainfall, and places for birds, wildlife. Trees are essential to the quality of life.
That's right. Yeah. And I mean, there's trees, again, people have trees in their yards, they're along the sides of the road, they're in the natural areas, they're essential for so many different reasons, whether it's to keep humans mentally or physically healthy. They're a major economy driver of the economy in South Carolina, and they have all sorts of natural benefits as far as biodiversity and all sorts of the critters that live in and on them.
We are going to focus today on a very hot topic in that it causes a lot of reactions in people, and that is glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in Roundup. And I think we think of that mostly as being used in agronomic crops. But from your experience, it's also a key management tool in forestry. Is that correct?
That's right. It's one of the most common and most effective tools we have against a lot of our invasive plants, something like privet. Glyphosate is one of the recommended treatments for privet. Glyphosate is a broad spectrum herbicide, so anything green that it touches, it will, if enough glyphosate gets on there, it will travel to the roots of that plant and kill it. So you do.
Let me interrupt you for just a minute. So if you're spraying a stand of pine trees mm-hmm. that have a nice thick bark on them, it does not go through the bark. Is that correct?
That's right. It's got to hit something green. So okay. If it's just getting on that rough, corky bark, you're not going to have a problem. It's got to get in touch with green stuff. Usually the foliage is what we target and aim for when we're applying glyphosate. But it is one of the chemicals we use in a lot of different ways. It can control a lot of different plants, and it's really useful for a lot of the invasive species we deal with.
So broad spectrum as opposed to a targeted plant or item. Talk a little bit about that so people can understand that some herbicides only affect one thing, some affect everything, please.
Sure. Broad spectrum means it has a broad range of things it will impact. So glyphosate is such a chemical that if it gets on a green plant, it can kill the green plant, whether that's a grass or a young maple tree or a weed of some sort, it can kill it. Now, there are other chemicals out there that only affect certain types of things. And a lot of times you can't make a herbicide that just affects one plant species. It's usually a type. So there's herbicides that only affect grasses, for instance. There's herbicides that will only kill, that will not kill pine trees, for instance. So what it does is sort of depends on how it's made and how it's derived, but glyphosate is one of those chemicals that will affect all sorts of different things.
I think probably homeowners most likely use targeted herbicides in lawns more than anything else, because there are some things that do not affect turf grass or certain types of turf grass, but might affect weedy, grassy weeds or broadleaf weeds. So I think some people who perhaps think that glyphosate is the devil incarnate don't realize that perhaps they're using herbicides themselves. They just don't make the connection sometimes.
Yeah, I would say anyone with a lawn service, you have herbicides on your lawn, and yes. they put stuff on there that's not going to kill the grass. You're just going to see, that's why after the lawn service has been there in a couple of weeks, all those little non-grass things sort of brown up and die off because they put an herbicide on there that kills broadleaf things, but not grass. So they're very common. It's pretty much impossible to look at a nice, pristine lawn and not have herbicides be a part of that.
Yes.
There's just too much other stuff that'll grow.
Tell us a little bit about the history of glyphosate, where it was developed and when it started having widespread agricultural uses, please.
Mm-hmm. It was first developed or found, I guess is probably a better word, in the 50s over in Switzerland. They were looking for something for a completely unrelated purpose. And then in the early 1970s is when it was first sort of rediscovered here in the States again for something completely different. They were looking to develop some chemicals to use in water softeners. So this was Monsanto was doing this at the time. Water softeners, yeah, completely unrelated. So they had over 100 of these chemicals they were trying to develop for water softener use. And two of them had some what they called mild herbicidal properties. So they gave this one fella the task, see if you can beef these up and get them to where we could, you know, market them and use them. So he worked on them and he was able to get one of them, glyphosate, it was actually the third one he tried, able to sort of develop that to the point where it could be used to kill plants. Okay. So Monsanto patented it, called it Roundup, and it was first marketed to the public in 1974. Okay, so this was when Roundup started, it was glyphosate and it was only Monsanto's. And the way pesticides work is when they're first developed, the company that creates them gets a patent on them. And so that, there's a patent, so they own the rights to it. And then they own the rights to it for a certain amount of time. So for a long time, the only glyphosate you could get was the brand name Roundup, and it was made by Monsanto.
Okay.
Around 2000, I believe, is when that protection left. So at that point, glyphosate basically became common thing. So any company could make it. And that's why today you can get glyphosate you can still get it as Roundup from Monsanto, but you can get it under all sorts of other trade names from all sorts of different companies. And if you go to any of the big box stores, it's usually just sold as weed killer, some generic weed killer thing. Mm-hmm. This has done a couple things. This has made it available in a lot more different forms and formulations, and it's also made the price drop significantly because once it's kind of like any pharmaceutical drug, right? The first one that has the new, diabetes drug, it's going to be really expensive for a while, but after a certain point in time, anyone can make one, and then you can get, generic anything. Generic ibuprofen is going to be cheaper than Motrin, for instance. So that's how that works.
So from your standpoint, was it first used widely in forest management and in agricultural field work?
It was, it was first developed for and used mostly in agricultural settings. I think forestry came to that a little bit later. Now it's one of the more widely used herbicides in forestry for sure. Again, for all those invasive species things we talked about, but it was developed for ag and that's kind of where it got its start. And then once we all saw the applicability of it and the ease of use and everything, it got used a lot more.
Let's talk a little bit more about it affects only green tissue actively growing, I understand, and within certain environmental parameters about temperature and things like that.
Right. It's the way glyphosate works is it impacts the plants. It's called the shikimic acid pathway, which is basically this molecular pathway where a plant makes amino acids. Okay, so plants can make their own amino acids grow. Vertebrates need to eat them, right? That's why we as people need to eat protein, because amino acids are in protein. We can't make our own. Plants make their own, and what glyphosate does is impact that whole process. It's a really big, complicated process, but it impacts that and basically prevents the plant from making what it needs to grow. As it gets sprayed on that green part, so glyphosate gets sprayed on a leaf, it will get inside that leaf and travel down into that plant and prevent that process from happening.
And that process is not one that mammals have.
Correct. Mammals don't have that process at all, right? That's why it works on all the plants, because every plant has to make its own amino acids. Right? Okay. So that's why that's a part of the broad spectrum, right? Every plant has this process it goes through. So that's how it works. And
temperature also is involved, I believe.
Yeah, I know. If it's too cold, a plant is not going to be doing a lot, right? A plant's not going to be moving things up and down, and it needs to take that herbicide and move it down into the roots and into the rest of the plant. So if it's too cold, it's not going to do that. So there's a set of parameters, environmental variables you've got to be within. And likewise, if you put it on right before rain, the rain will probably wash it off that leaf. It's got to take some time from after it gets on, it's sprayed on the leaf. It's got to have time to soak in, basically. And if you spray, you know, right before as a rainstorm is coming, it's going to wash that off and it probably won't work.
Apparently too, the plant's just not actively having all of its processes going on. Is that correct?
In the fall, most plants are shutting down. So that's why, you know, when those leaves start to turn colors, what's happening is that this, where the leaf joins that plant, it's basically closing off all of those little
precision layer. Yeah.
So if you spray it on a leaf in the fall, that plant is already closing off all those tissues, and that chemical is not going to get down into the where it needs to go in the plant to kill it. So timing is very important. It's really needs to be sprayed when that plant is actively growing.
Okay.
So that's important.
And then there are some applications where it's used on a cut stump or something like that, and that's used.
You can use it as that method. There's other things that are maybe a little more effective. Triclopyr is maybe a little more effective than glyphosate. I generally advise people that if you're going to spray the leaves of something, glyphosate's a great option. Uh-huh. If you're going to spray a stump or something like that, there's stuff that will work a bit better than glyphosate. So that's what I often tell people.
For a homeowner that just has one thing in their shed, the lock shed, sometimes I think glyphosate, if you're cutting down little cherry laurels or something like that.
Probably. Right, yeah. Yeah, smaller. You know, a lot of that smaller stuff you can use glyphosate for. It'll work well enough, is how I like to say.
Following the directions.
Always following the directions. And that's a very important point I think we should talk about is every chemical has a label, right? Every herbicide, pesticide, insecticide, all of them have labels. And those labels are officially the law in this country. So when it says on there, you need to apply it at certain conditions, that means that's when you need to apply it, both legally and for it to work. Like if you don't apply it under those conditions, it won't work. It'll also tell you the proper PPE, which is personal protective equipment that needs to be worn. And for most, for all pesticides, this includes long pants, closed-toed shoes or boots preferably, long-sleeve shirt, safety glasses, safety gloves, you know, rubber gloves, and probably a hat as well. So it's important to have these things on because this is going to, it's the label and it's the law, but it also prevents any, potential things that might happen to you as the applicator. So it's always very important to remember that these things need to be worn when you're using chemicals.
There is a kind of widespread feeling of animosity towards Monsanto in some ways, because Monsanto came out with Roundup Ready crops. As I understand it, David, it's such an effective tool to control weeds, but the way they at first when they could only spray the weeds as the plants got larger, sometimes they couldn't control the weeds as well. And so they used genetically modified the seeds, introducing things that made them immune to the effects of glyphosate. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And the way, you know, those GM crops, they would call it Roundup Ready soybeans or Roundup Ready, you know, whatever. The way they worked is they modified the molecular pathways in those plants. There's usually an enzyme that glyphosate will get in and it will affect a particular enzyme that's in that whole shikimic acid pathway. And what they were able to do is just modify it so that that enzyme is no longer affected by the glyphosate. Mm-hmm. Like nothing else in the plant is different. It's just that they basically turned a switch to make when glyphosate got on there, that the enzyme didn't recognize it or something to that effect. And so it didn't kill the particular crop plant. This allowed farmers to spray at different times of the year. You know, as the crop plants maybe got a little bit bigger, you could just spray over the top of them and not worry about killing everything, because the Roundup wouldn't impact the crop plant, but it would kill all the non-crop things, which was very beneficial then, because, you know, soybeans, for instance, when you went in there in the late summer or fall to harvest them, you didn't have any of those big weeds everywhere. You just had crop plants and that's it. Roundup Ready stuff was a big step in our country's agriculture. It greatly increased our yields and production. And it was a really, you know, when we look at the history of agriculture in the U.S., that's going to be a really significant thing, you know, the whole Roundup Ready crops.
Unfortunately, you always have some resistant individuals. And there were some other schemes that could have been used perhaps to reduce weed load. And I understand that farmers, it was so easy to use the Roundup, and I'm probably going to get somebody mad at me for saying this, but some of my agronomy friends have said that it was just so easy that perhaps some other steps weren't taken. And all of a sudden we had some resistant weeds. Amaranth, which is a male and has male and female plants with massive amounts of pollen and massive amounts of female flowers. And so you're just going to have a few individuals that are going to be resistant, and they started proliferating in fields, and farmers were actually having to go in and grub them out by hand and carry these plants to the edge of the field. And so that led to a new genetically modified corn, soybean, cotton that allowed them to use a different herbicide that had a lot more complications to it than Roundup, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I guess to your first point, anytime we use a chemical to control something, whether it's herbicide for weeds, insecticide for different insects, there's going to be, if that chemical is used too much and over too much area, eventually nature will find a way, as they say, right? And there will become some individuals that are resistant to that chemical. It's happened with weeds, it's happened with bugs. We've got all sorts of examples where all of a sudden we have resistant pests. And that just happens, you know, it just takes, it's partially why it's so important, if you're going to treat something chemically, you apply it the right way, because we get resistance when a pest doesn't get the full coverage of whatever we're trying to spray on it, right? If a weed just gets glyphosate on a couple leaves and it's not enough to kill that plant, that's how some things can trigger to help that plant develop resistance. If an insect gets just a little bit on there but not enough to kill it, then all of a sudden you've got an insect that has survived this insecticide, and they can start, you know, those will survive, and the pests with those genes propagate, and they get more of those survivors, and that's how we get that resistance. So that happened with you know, glyphosate in this case. And so then you know, this kind of leads us to dicamba, because that was the thing that we started using here more recently, not just immediately recently, but a little more recently, that really got in the news, you know, because of Roundup and glyphosate. We're seeing, like you said, we're seeing some resistance in certain weeds. So dicamba was the next chemical that came out that was going to be used as kind of a broad spectrum.
David, let me back up just a minute, because let's talk a little bit about how glyphosate lasts and persists, and the danger of it going to the non-target organisms. As I understand it, and from reading the label when I use glyphosate, which I do, like in my vegetable garden, if I'm going to plant, you know, I might have some weeds out there, and I don't till anymore. I use no-till. And so I can go out and, following the directions, spray to kill the weeds. And I read the label, and generally within the next, I can go out the next morning and put seeds in, because it does not go into the soil and have any residual activity. It just affects the green plants. Some herbicides go into the soil and last there. The other thing is that I need to be careful that it's not windy, but I don't think that glyphosate doesn't, it can be blown by the wind and hit something I didn't intend for it to affect, but it's not going to turn into a gas and float off. Is that correct?
Yeah, you nailed all that. So glyphosate is, it breaks down very quickly in sunlight, breaks down very quickly when it hits the soil. It's got a very short half-life in there. I too have sprayed glyphosate on one day on the afternoon, and I've planted stuff the next morning with no problems, right? It's, you know, as soon as it's dry, it's pretty much gone. It's kind of my unofficial thing. Like if you can't feel wetness on the leaves, you're probably safe to do whatever you need to do. It just doesn't
turn into a gas.
Right. And it won't turn into a gas. You know, there's some chemicals that when you spray them, if it's too hot, they volatilize, and then they're floating around out there and can get on other things and cause a lot of damage. Roundup or glyphosate will blow. It can drift. Any pesticide can drift. If you're spraying it and it's windy, it's just blowing what you're spraying around. That can happen to any chemical anywhere. So drift is a very common thing. That's why it's very important to, you know, monitor your outside conditions. You're not supposed to spray if it's going to be windy. And even just a light wind is too much for a lot of herbicide applications, because it does not take much to blow some of those really fine droplets around. So it's got to be a pretty still time. Generally speaking, early morning is a pretty good no wind time. That's when I do a lot of my spraying, is, you know, just starting just before sunup till mid-morning. It's usually pretty calm, you know, and as temperatures rise through the day, that's when you get more wind, as kind of the air is moving up and down the atmosphere. But the calmer, the better for that.
And then also, we found that with dicamba, it's been far more problematic because of the fact that I believe it's more expensive.
And yeah, you know, one of the benefits of glyphosate is now that it is no longer a protected thing for Monsanto, that anyone can make it, the cost has come way, way down. Glyphosate, on the overall scheme of herbicides, glyphosate is one of, if not the cheapest one out there. Anything new like dicamba, that's going to be still under that time period where it's only made by one company, it's protected, it's going to be a lot more expensive. Glyphosate you can get anywhere at this point, right? It's a lot cheaper, and it still works very well when it's used the right way.
So the second generation of GMO herbicide resistant crops is now dicamba resistant, and dicamba is extremely likely under certain conditions to turn into a gas, and it may go into your neighbor's yard or another farmer's field where you did not want it to go, and all of a sudden you are in a real pickle.
That's right. Yeah, dicamba is you know, a few years ago there was a lot of things in the news with this, you know, dicamba problems everywhere, people losing whole fields of crops, and what was happening, we found out that it was volatilizing, right? So not drifting. So it wasn't being blown by the wind. It was being applied mostly in a right manner, but when it got too warm, it was basically turning into a gas, teeny tiny liquid droplets floating around and getting on all those other crops and then having that same herbicide effect. It's just, you know, some of these things, you need to read the label, and it will tell you, don't apply if the temperature is over X degrees. They put that on there for a reason. And the reason is to make sure that chemical is going to work the right way and not cause unintended damage.
And, you know, a lot of times it's interesting that people who grow roses, for instance, are cautioned and warned to change the mode of activity of the fungicide periodically, mm-hmm. because resistance can occur. And so even with, and as you talked about with insects, and we, all of us, from an individual raising a rose to a farmer, to a forest manager, we all need to be aware of the fact that although something may be easy just to keep using the same thing, that's not the best management practice.
That's right. And, you know, fungi are notorious for having just a really unique life cycle and changing. They change fast. You know, over the course of a year, a season, you can see fungi almost develop resistance. So it's so true. And this is, it gets back to having an integrated management plan, integrated pest management plan. If you do the same thing over and over and over and over again, eventually that pest is going to figure out a way around it, whether it's developing resistance or what. But you got to change up your methods. Yep.
At the EPA, which is where our pesticides are evaluated and allowed, or allowed with restrictions, and where they come up with all the rules that safely guard the environment and the applicator, we have a pretty strong science-based community who are dedicated to this. Sadly, we've had some cases where glyphosate, which in the broad scheme of things is relatively safe when used according to the label, has been found in jury trials. They have ruled against Monsanto, and there have been some court cases, some evidence that's been brought in and some evidence that was not allowed to be brought in. Can you talk a little bit about that case and some of the things we've learned about what the people who were bringing the case that said they'd been harmed by it, what they had been and not been doing to protect themselves, and the kind of general attitude towards large corporations in California where that happened?
Sure, and I feel compelled to say that I'm not an oncologist and I'm not a lawyer, but yeah. You know, I am a I am a scientist, so I look at these things from a data perspective, and that's how I form all my opinions on all this. So what, you know, what happened, Amanda, was a few years ago, there were a couple court cases in California where some people, first one was an individual landscaper, the second one was a couple, sued Monsanto because they claimed that glyphosate gave them cancer. I believe the cancer was non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a fairly common type of cancer. So they sued Monsanto and said that your chemical caused my cancer because of the repeated use that I've done over my lifetime. Right? For the first one, he was a mid-60s-year-old gentleman who had worked in landscape care for the past 40 years. I believe he worked at a school, but he was in charge of landscape for 40 years. The case went to federal court in San Francisco, California. And so, you know, there's a lot to unpack here. There's the EPA, we'll talk about the EPA first. This is our Environmental Protection Agency. You know, the EPA is constantly screening all of the pesticides for use in America. The EPA has screened glyphosate repeatedly, and they have found over the past four administrations, so Clinton, Democrat, Bush, Republican, Obama, Democrat, Trump, Republican, all four of those EPAs have found glyphosate to be safe to use if used appropriately. So I think the first thing to understand is the EPA calling glyphosate safe to use under those conditions is not a partisan type thing. It's completely bipartisan. Okay, so they're looking at data available and they're deciding that if you use this right, it's going to be okay. But, you know, in some parts of the country, there's an anti-corporate attitude, for lack of a better word, right? And Monsanto has taken its fair share of criticism over some of its, you know, practices, not, you know, the fact that farmers can't bank seed and plant it the next year. You've got to buy seed every year new, you know. You could argue this is just a good business practice. You could argue that it's just making the farmers pay extra. That's not what we're getting into today. The point is there's a good number of people out there that are kind of anti big corporation in general, whether it's Microsoft, Monsanto, whatever. California is sort of known as having, you know, it's a more liberal state that has a little bit more of that attitude overall. Okay, certainly not everybody would overall. So there was this lawsuit went in this area. Presumably the jury that was there had a little bit more anti-big ag corporate bias. Sure. And like you and I spoke earlier, I said if this case had been in somewhere like Wichita, Kansas, we would probably have a completely different discussion right now, right? But it happened in California. It happened there. Clearly, there was a very good lawyer on the part of the plaintiff. And, you know, they're asking a jury of non-scientists to make a decision of science. They're asking a jury of non-scientists to decide, how does this chemical affect the human body? I would wager none of those jury people were actual scientists. None of them were probably oncologists, and probably none of them were biochemists either, right? This is this is one of the things we get by having a jury of our peers. So it's kind of like, I think of it as the perfect storm is what happened here. You had the right location, good lawyer, a compelling story, right? Landscaper gets cancer after using glyphosate for 40 years. One little piece of data that was what I would call cherry picked by their lawyer is there's a group called the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the IARC. It's a group based out of Europe, and they rate everything. They rate all sorts of compounds on how potentially carcinogenic might they be.
Okay? Yes.
So they're looking at, is there a potential for that? They ranked glyphosate as probably carcinogenic.
Okay.
So here's two other things they put in the probably carcinogenic category. They put red meat and they put coffee.
Whoa. Okay.
So those things are also, according to this group, probably carcinogenic. And probably is not even the worst category. They've actually got a category called known human carcinogens.
Yeah.
Okay. Glyphosate is not a known human carcinogen, but things that are include sunlight, alcohol, and processed meat.
Right. Okay.
So according to the IARC, a hot dog is more dangerous than glyphosate.
And sunlight, of course.
And sunlight, right? And alcohol, right? Which is a legal, you know, so.
And tobacco also.
Tobacco, right, right. So, you know, this lawyer was good, and that's kind of all I can say. And anyone that has worked in oncology will tell you, if you have a 65-year-old person who has done landscape care their whole life, who has not worn the proper PPE like they should have.
Is that one of the things that came out, this person?
So in the second case, it was a couple, and they had basically done the same thing, been doing their own landscape care their whole life. They freely admitted they never wore the PPE they should have.
Right.
So they didn't use this the whole time. So right away, you're using glyphosate illegally. Because you're not wearing the proper PPE and just not smart. You're not putting the stuff on you should. But you know, lawyers were able to take this thing from the IARC and say, look, jury, this is probably carcinogenic. This person uses for 40 years. They have cancer. There's your fault. And it just sort of all spun together in the right situation, and they found against, you know, the verdict went against Monsanto. Now, of course, that initial judgment was sky high. I forget how many millions of dollars it was, but it was greatly, greatly, greatly reduced on all the appeals and all that thing. You know, from a scientific perspective, though, there's no credible data that shows glyphosate is dangerous if you use it the right way, if you wear the right protection, and if you follow a label. So that's my position on all of that.
And again, I'm going to go back to the best management practices of not relying on simply one herbicide. If you wrote a paper about that, we would be the cost that would occur to agriculture and forestry management would dramatically increase if we lost glyphosate. And I know within forestry, invasive species, we've got an area where wisteria took over a huge area and they had to clear cut. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, which people still plant. would it really reduce the profitability of agriculture and forestry if we lost this tool?
I very much think it would. I think the impact is going to be, if this happens, I think the impact would be much more than we are expecting, to be honest with you. It's used commonly. It's something that's fairly straightforward to use, and it really is so much cheaper than all the other stuff out there. Now, you know, there's sort of two questions. If we lose glyphosate, can we still control all the weed species we need to? Yes, we can. There are things out there we can use that will work as well as glyphosate. So it's not that we all of a sudden can't control weeds. It's going to be more expensive to do that, and that means that cost per acre is going to go up. That reduces the profit margins, and that's going to have all sorts of economic impacts going down, you know, downstream from where we're there. So, and this is just a fact. The other stuff out there is not as cheap as glyphosate, and that's just the, kind of the bottom line.
And in some cases, has application problems that make it a lot less targeted and harder to control in some ways.
Right. I mean, you know, glyphosate has so many uses, natural areas, urban areas, lawns, gardens, all of that type of thing. And so to lose that, all of a sudden you're going to be using many different things, all of which are more expensive than glyphosate, versus having kind of this catch-all, maybe that's the wrong word, but having this chemical you can use in so many different ways because it's so... It's just so many different uses for it.
And also, I want to remind people that Roundup's kind of the go-to thing, because that was, you know, a lot for a lot of us. You know, we know that that's the easiest thing for somebody to pick up. It's sold under now, as you said, lots of other names, all containing glyphosate, but different formulations may have some extra chemicals in them that make them have different effects. And so you need to read that label and read the active ingredient list. And if it has things other than inert ingredients, if it has glyphosate at 41%, and then it's got some other chemical names there, that means that it's going to act differently. It might last in the soil. There are lots of different formulations out there. So I encourage people, don't just make an automatic choice. Look at that label, the active ingredients are on there. You may have to get out your eyeglasses. I certainly do to read that fine print, but that fine print's pretty important. And, yep. And go in and take the time to read the label, particularly read the label of what you're supposed to do if somehow you get it on you, because you don't want to have a spill on you and then you're desperately trying to figure out what am I supposed to do. And I just caution people to don't automatically just say, oh, this is a bottle of whole milk, or skim milk, I'm taking it home. Read the label, keep it safe. If you can't, if the label gets wet, you can pull the label up online and read it there, can't you?
Yeah, all of those, every label for pesticides is available online. There's a great website, cdms.net, that has all those things on there. You can go there and just type in your formulation. There your labels will come. They've got them all. Everything you said is so true. You've got to be careful when you're mixing this stuff. You should be wearing the right articles of clothing and protection, glasses, hat, gloves, boots, all that stuff. Don't just go out there in shorts and sandals and think you're going to spray all the stuff you want to kill, because you're exposing your body, you're exposing that stuff, and you just don't want to do that. So be sure you follow that label, do it the right way, and if you apply it the right way in the right manner, there's no reason to think that there's any danger to you.
Even washing your clothes, they will tell you how to wash your clothes.
Yes, whenever I'm using any type of pesticides, the way I do it, if I'm spraying something at home, we've got a little acreage out back, I will put an extra set of clothes, in the garage. And then when I am done spraying pesticides, I'd take those off in the garage, shut the garage door obviously first, but you know, take your clothes off there, leave them there. I go get cleaned up, and then I will come back later with gloves on and put those clothes and those spray clothes only directly in the washer, get those run through, and I don't wash other things with them. You sort of keep that set of clothing separate. I've got a separate pair of boots I wear for forestry activities. I wear those for pesticide. I don't wear those if I'm just out hiking with my kids or anything like that, right? So I've got separate stuff. I've got a separate hat I wear, and that gets washed every time too. So it's just, you know, it's just being smart and keeping that stuff, taking maybe extra precautions just to be completely safe about it.
Yeah. Thank you, David Coyle, for helping people, I hope, come to at least maybe a slightly more knowledge, science-based understanding of glyphosate, and also for encouraging people to realize that even though we feel it's one of the safest products we have for its use, that does not mean that we can go out there and use it haphazardly. Use it as a tool that we are fortunate to have, but it is a chemical tool, and we must follow the directions all the time.
That's right. Thank you, Manna. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, David. Till next time. Bye-bye.